It's the 19th of October 2012, and you're listening to The Pod Delusion, a podcast about interesting things. I'm James O'Malley. Coming up this week, we answer the questions. Are Putin stooges who convicted Pussy Riot working for the clampdown? Why might young criminals need their heads checking? If 16-year-olds were allowed to vote, how would Eric Pickles make himself appear down with the kids? And are self-driving cars the obvious answer to Apple Maps being terrible? But before we begin, the traditional begging slot. Now, if you enjoy the Pod Delusion and would like to support what we do, then do head over to our website at poddelusion.co.uk and subscribe and donate £5 or £10 a month, or make a one-off donation. All donations help us keep making the show week in, week out, and really are appreciated. God, it's like buying us a couple of drinks a month. You can find links to donate at poddelusion.co.uk. And secondly, before we begin, also head over to our website and follow the links to find out about the brand new Soho Skeptics event in London. The Pod Delusion is on board as a supporter, along with the excellent Little Atoms podcast, the Skeptic magazine, as well as London Skeptics in the Pub, and a bunch of other people, including our convener Martin Robbins, who you may know as a Pod Delusion contributor and Guardian writer. Our first talk is going to be on November the 7th with Chris Atkins, who you may know as the director of the films Starsuckers and Taking Liberties. He's going to be giving us a talk on media manipulation from Hillsborough to Leveson. Tickets are available now, and you can find links to buy them from our website at poddelusion.co.uk. And future events also include a mystery event on the 25th of November that we'll hopefully have more on soon. On the 5th of December, we've got Ben Goldacre, who you may remember from the show a few weeks ago, talking about Bad Pharma. And in January, we've got Jim Malinovich and friends talking about, well, I'm not entirely sure yet, but I'm sure it's going to be excellent. So yeah, check out the Soho Skeptics. You can find links to find out more on poddelusion.co.uk. But now, finally, let's get on with the show. And we start the show this week with Pussy Riot, the Russian punk band who had three of their members jailed back in August for an anti-Putin punk prayer protest in a church. Needless to say, the church, blasphemy, and causing so-called religious offence were all used as a reason why they should be locked up. I know what you're thinking. It's a good job they didn't post anything nasty on Facebook in Britain instead, otherwise they could be in real trouble. Last Monday in Parliament, Kerry McCarthy, the Labour MP for Bristol East, held a meeting all about Pussy Riot, now that it looks like they're going to be spending some time, literally, in a penal colony, or gulag, to use the traditional term. I got a chance to speak to her about her involvement in the campaign to freedom, and started by asking her exactly how she got involved.
Going back quite a few months, I'd sort of read about Pussy Riot in, well, I'd say in the music press, but I don't think you read things, it's more music websites these days. So sites like Louder Than War was almost certainly where I heard of it first. And I studied Russian at university. I'd been to Russia quite a few times. So it was that the interest sort of came from a combination of being interested in the sort of, you know, punk, alternative, whatever you want to call it, music scene, but the whole sort of countercultural type of political protest, as well as being interested in Russian things. So I sort of got a little bit involved in it, tweeted about it a bit, sort of did a little bit to publicise the case, which didn't really make much headway in terms of the political establishment here, if you like. It's seen as quite a sort of, you know, sort of slightly bizarre little episode over in Russia. But then because of that, the people from the Pussy Riot campaign got in touch with me and said, we'd really love you to come over for the trial. And just almost like on the spur of the moment, because they thought the trial would last about a month, and then suddenly decided it would last about a week. So I literally had about 48 hours to decide, right, that's it, I'm going, running around getting a visa. So I was there for the last 2 days of the trial. And I think once you've done that, you feel a sort of, you know, obviously far more connection with the three women that were involved, much more of a sort of personal investment, yeah, in the outcome. And so I thought it was important to carry on trying to pursue the issue once they've been jailed, because obviously it's quite shocking to see three young women in a glass box in court for 2 days, and then you realise that, well, two of them are now off to the penal colonies. Katia, thankfully, has been released. But I thought doing something in Parliament is when you really raise it to that level where you're trying to get a lot of people talking about it, and we've got a really good list of people coming along today as well.
So what was it like actually seeing the trial take place? I mean, did it match British standards for sort of due process and so on from your perspective? I mean, did the Russian authorities, did anyone notice that you were a British Member of Parliament watching it? That might raise any eyebrows or anything?
Well, the court officials were really helpful, actually. Mm. So I was allowed to queue jump, and there was only like about four rows of seats. There were maybe like 50 people were allowed in the court. Mm. It was quite a pretty small room. And yeah, I suppose the difference between that and a UK courtroom is, you know, lots of men with guns and Rottweilers and Alsatians. The Rottweiler and Alsatians were sort of on a sort of job share thing, so they alternated. So the officials were fine about me being there. The defence lawyers had got me in, but it's just very different from the UK system. And some of it, you can't criticise because it's just a different way of doing things, and most European countries have a different way of conducting criminal proceedings to the UK system. But it was certainly the case that the defence didn't get the chance to put across what they wanted to say in the way that the prosecution did. So you had lawyers for the prosecution, you then had lawyers for what were called the victims, who were the people that had seen the performance and said that they were distressed by it, who were pretty much allowed free rein to say what they wanted to do, and they brought some of the so-called victims along. But then on the defence side, they were shut down by the judge every time they tried to do anything. They weren't allowed to introduce their own witnesses. And it was just very... Even so much as the judge wouldn't look at the... Whether the women got... It was one of the things that's different to the UK system. The women actually got quite a lot of chance to speak themselves and make statements from the dock. And the judge wouldn't even look at them. Whereas with the prosecution witnesses, she'd be looking at them and sort of very, very different sort of response.
As we've seen the one member of the band released this week, I mean, how do you think things will play out now? Do you think we'll see the other two released?
Well, the next step is they've got no further right of appeal. So they only had this, which was actually appealing against sentence. They didn't have a right of appeal against conviction. Unless they could go for presidential pardon, but that means admitting their guilt, and they've just made very clear that they don't... Yeah, the offence they were convicted of was hooliganism motivated by religious hatred, and they've just made it very clear that they don't regard themselves as guilty of that, so they won't go for the pardon. The next step would be taking it to European Court of Human Rights, which is why all the fundraising is important, because obviously that costs money. And that will be really interesting, because it puts the whole of the Russian legal system, political system and everything under the spotlight. But, yeah, that obviously takes quite a lot of time, so... I think what they're trying to work on now is whether they'd be allowed to serve their sentences in Moscow in the jail rather than being sent out to penal colonies, because the penal colonies are some distant, they're like hundreds of miles out of Moscow, not really being able to see their families. They've got young kids, both of the two that are in there have got very young kids, weren't allowed to see them at all when they're in jail. So that's being debated at the moment, but I think the European Court on Human Rights said a few years ago, Moscow banned gay pride in 2006, 2007, 2008, that sort of time. They banned pride, and they were held to be in breach of the European Convention, but now they've just banned it for the next 100 years. So that kind of maybe says a lot about how much weight they give to whatever the judgment is.
Is there anything that Britain and other countries can actually do about this? I mean, why are Russia even likely to listen to international...
It's tricky because they're playing to two audiences, and from Putin's point of view, it's as important to appear to be the tough man at home. What leverage do we really have in terms of... You know, the UK government here have said... You know, I've got a letter from the Minister for Europe that says that they've made representations. But it's one of those things that quite often issues like that... they come way down the agenda. When you've got a bilateral, say, UK-Russia... There's all sorts of issues to do with trade and probably energy supplies and security and all the, you know, Afghanistan or whatever. And then Pussy Riot might get a mention because people have been urging them to mention it. But it's a bit like Tibet and China. Yeah. You know, it gets a mention so you can say you've mentioned it, but it's not actually the linchpin upon which all the negotiations hinge, and, you know, it's not on the negotiating
table. Is it one of these, perhaps, like, tit-for-tat things, like, they'll forgive Pussy Riot if we turn a blind eye at them poisoning Litvinenko? I'm not putting in such crass terms, but you know, like, how exchange spies or a spies accord is just sort of part of the game.
But I just don't think it would ever be in the mix in that sort of way, because obviously if you've had a crime that's been committed on British soil, you're not going to sort of treat it in the same way. And I don't think it's up for negotiation in that way. There is an issue about how Russia's regarded in the outside world. So when I was there, Madonna did the concert in Moscow when she wrote Pussy Riot, Free Pussy Riot, on her back. And that does have, yeah, it has quite an impact because she's playing to huge audiences there. But it's always very difficult to keep the momentum up, you know, once they've been jailed. How do you... And that's one of the things I think we'll discuss in tonight's meeting is how do you avoid just preaching to the converted, because it can all become quite self-congratulatory. We're all sitting around saying, yeah, we all support Pussy Riot, but we're the kind of people who would.
Yeah.
You know, and we're not the people who need to be convinced. So it is... I do think the European court is going to be interesting. It might well be, you know, just when the fuss has died down, they'll say, well, let them out early. You know, they've served part of their sentence. But there's also... Yeah, I met quite a few. I met a couple of other members of Pussy Riot when I was out there, and I met people who were involved in the campaign. And there's a lot of arrests happening for people that... there were some guys that had got on a balcony outside the courtroom a few days before I'd arrived, and they were just sort of, they put balaclavas on and they were dancing around. And I met one of those who was off to court, and he got sentenced to 7 days in jail for it. So there's a lot of little incidents like that, and... I think that will be the sort of interesting thing, is next time there's a big political protest in Russia, and you know, you've had people like Garry Kasparov, the former chess champion, being arrested. You've had some quite senior politicians like Boris Nemtsov, who used to be deputy prime minister, arrested. So I think it will be all those things coming together rather than being specifically about Pussy Riot.
What's the best thing people listening to? Because our listeners, I don't imagine that many of them are, you know, card-carrying punks, but I reckon they'll feel a lot of solidarity with this, as we cover free speech issues all the time.
Well, there's Amnesty International are very much... They've deemed them to be prisoners of conscience, and obviously their letter-writing campaigns and everything. They've got what they call an action that's being launched today. So if you go on the Amnesty website, you should be able to see that, which is basically about writing to your MP, trying to sort of keep up the momentum. I think there was a petition that they tried to present to the Russian embassy, but the Russian embassy just refused to take it. So that was a while ago. But that's the main thing they can do, you know, if they can put on fundraising gigs. And I think the thing is with the gigs and events that I've done so far, it's not really just about Pussy Riot, you know, it's about... There's so many issues that they raise, you know, about the freedom to... Yeah, you know, it's freedom of speech, it's the right to, you know... use art, I guess, as a form of political protest. But then there's also the whole feminism debate. They were, you know, sort of criticised in court for being feminist. The prosecuting lawyer said, well, no, the victim's lawyer said that it was feminism is a mortal sin or something. And there was all this thing about you're a danger to the public, you're a threat to Russian values. That's one of... It was even said at the appeal hearing just now that you're not safe to be let out on the streets, you know. So there's all that, yeah, about to what extent do you tolerate people who are outside the mainstream, and quite why are they seen as so dangerous. So yeah, there's an awful lot of issues that you end up talking about, which you'll probably see at tonight's event.
Well, we'll certainly put links to the petition on the Pod Delusion website. I mean, finally then, a little more obtusely perhaps, I mean, do you think there's an irony in our complaining or our raising about awareness about Pussy Riot and so on, especially given it was just last week in Britain someone was, for instance, convicted and sentenced to prison for writing a nasty message on Facebook?
Yeah.
I mean, there's all sorts of... There's weird free speech issues closer to home.
Yeah.
How do we reconcile?
Yeah, I think so. People have said things like the Charlie Gilmore case swinging on the Cenotaph or whatever, which... There was a lot of sentencing around the riots, which was really on the on the inside. And the Facebook stuff does really worry me. And I think it's something that we need to have a debate about. Because obviously, you know, it's offensive and upsetting. And I think there's a bit of a difference between threats on Facebook that are directly aimed at somebody and very directly intimidating, you know, in the way that stalkerish behaviour is, or just generally saying offensive things, which I think is what the case was. And then you've just got this guy that was given, I think, 4 months for wearing a T-shirt about the police. I don't know whether you saw that. And then it turns out his son died in police custody and he's got mental health issues. So yeah, I think there's a, you know, we're not saying that we're perfect at all, and that is something that gets thrown back at me quite a lot, is why aren't you talking about these cases in the UK? I think the answer is, yeah, we should be talking about the cases in the UK as well. But I think it's different in that it's, you have a lot more freedom to speak out about issues in the UK. So it's more about how the police are issuing guidelines soon on the use of social media and what's acceptable and what isn't, what shouldn't be prosecuted. So the debate is more about what's offensive and what isn't, rather than what's politically acceptable or not. They don't tend to be political protests as such. You could say that the cenotaph thing was, but I think that was deemed to be more about offending the war dead rather than if he climbed up on the gates of Number 10, it would have been a different
issue. I mean, if punks had broken into Westminster Abbey and...
Well, that's what people always say. I mean, Peter Tatchell interrupted the Archbishop of Canterbury sermon years ago, and it was to do a protest about gay priests, and he got fined £18. Which even in today's money isn't very much money. So that's the closest equivalent. That was actually a packed church service, interrupted him in the middle of that, said, you know, there's a lot of gay priests out there, and I don't know whether he was trying to out them or quite what it was, and, you know, like, so that was the closest thing I can say. I mean, people always say to me, well, what would happen if they did it in Westminster Abbey? And I suspect they'd just get out and told to stop being so silly. I don't know.
Brilliant. We'll leave it there. Let you go on with the event. Okay. Karen McCarthy, thank you very much.
Chairing the meeting at Parliament was punk historian John Robb, who's also the frontman for the band Goldblade. And for any older punks listening, they may know him from The Membranes. He was also there and fully supportive of Pussy Riot, so I sat down with him to look at the punk context. Okay, so I'm here with John Robb, the musician, journalist, author of Punk Rock and Oral History, founder of the website Louder Than War, and frontman for Goldblade. And you're speaking at the meeting tonight. Now, what brought you along?
Well, I'm chairing the panel tonight. It's kind of a thing we've been interested in a long time. I think we're probably about the first people to cover the Pussy Riot thing on the website. In January, at a point in time when nobody's actually that interested, that was quite odd because you get about 30 hits on the story, and that's quite low for the website, very low for the website. And it's because one of those things that very low level for months, and suddenly it banged and became like a big kind of media story. But my interest in it, because I've been coming right from the start, I always think in terms that the punk rock's an international community, and we kind of look out for all the people and all the other countries if they're getting in any trouble or not. Because at the same time, there was a parallel-ish kind of case in Indonesia. I don't know if you remember that one.
With the punks and the shaving heads.
They shaved their heads. The cops came down and beat them up at a gig and shaved their heads and made them read the Quran and things. So we're running that story. And then somebody said, you know about this Pussy Riot thing in Russia. So that was that's how we got onto actually, because of the Indonesian thing, yeah.
How remarkable is what's happening to Pussy Riot? I mean, you cite the Indonesian case.
It's interesting how they become like an international cause célèbre when there's quite a lot of other things happening. Well, not a lot of other things, but every now and then, like the Indonesian people, everyone's forgotten about them. I think some of them ended up in jail as well, didn't they? Just for having punk haircuts. But I suppose the Pussy Riot, there's definitely a political aspect to it because it was the anti-Putin thing. And there's anti-Putin protests last year. And I suppose that it kind of coalesced around Pussy Riot, and that became... For the Russians, the point that you had to put somebody in jail, it was going to be them. I just think it's kind of like a really ridiculous overreaction. But I know a lot of people in Russia are actually very pro them being in prison. I mean, even very liberal people I know think they should be in prison. So that's quite weird. I think over here we assume that everyone in Russia is up in arms about it, but they're not really. I think they're quite on their own over there, which doesn't make it right, you know. It makes their situation even more desperate in a way. I think it was a mistake of Putin to put them in there. I think there's pressure from the church as well. But I don't think anybody comes out of this one as a winner, really, do they? Because it just makes the Russian government look pretty stupid to the rest of the world. If they'd ignored it, like basically what happens over here, ever since the punk days, you've pretty well been ignored. You can make as much protest as you want. No, the government's so smart over here, they don't put you in prison because they know if you keep shouting, no one's listening. But that's how it works if you've got dissent in a creative kind of way. But they've never been very good at that in East Europe, have they? They've never been very good at ignoring artists and poets and musicians when they're causing trouble.
So you've written extensively on the history of punk rock. I mean, are there any other similar protests in the past? And how have they turned out, if there were any?
Well, there's been similar-ish protests, but not exactly the same. As I mean, you could draw a parallel with Crass or something, but they didn't do any direct kind of action-style protests. They made records, they put... interesting ideas out into what was pretty well mainstream then, because they were selling an awful lot of records. And they had police harassment, but in a sense, their police harassment was so British. The police would go around to the house once a week, knock on the door, and ask them what they're up to. And Crass would ask them, say, come in and have a cup of tea. And they would sit there and talk about what they'd been up to and the weather for about an hour and go again. And they did have the phone tapped and all that kind of thing was going on. But they never got arrested, you know, they didn't get put in jail for it. There have been instances, you know, of course, in rock and roll when people have been put in jail, but it's usually for like taking too many drugs or carrying drugs around them, which is like a different kind of debate, really. So in the UK, political discourse has usually carried on the way I was saying before, where you basically just get ignored. You know, the radio suddenly just won't play your records, you know, that records. They don't say it's too political, they'll just say it's not what we normally play. So, you know, God Save the Queen was a very political record by the Sex Pistols in a way that it probably wasn't that political at all. You know, it's basically just to cause trouble to sell records. But for a lot of people, it was a big rallying call. Lots of women 16 thought that was a political record. We didn't realise that perhaps it wasn't really. But that didn't result in them getting thrown in prison directly for making that record. So that makes it different as well.
Mm. Do you know much about the Russian punk scene? I mean, are Pussy Riot a big deal over there, or is this the incident which has made them the big deal?
I've played Russia about 3 times, and I've played quite big gigs in Russia. We supported a Russian punk band in a stadium. They were a bit like the Pogues.
Mm.
And we hung out with them. They were good guys, but they had some attitudes that weren't the same as ours, you know, let's put it that way.
Mm.
We met some Russian punk bands who were kind of normal, kind of punk rock politics, kind of Dead Kennedy style politics. We met other ones who were a mixture of right and left wing at the same time. I mean, so you can't assume that Russia is the same kind of place as the UK. It's from what our experience of being there, which probably amounts to about 3.5 weeks in total, it's quite different. There's quite a big right wing thing going on there, and it's much more nationalistic than England. It's like being in England during a World Cup game, but every day of the year. So they're very proud people, which is nothing wrong being proud now. So that's always thing with this. You have to like handle this in a anti-Russian kind of way, because it puts their backs up more than anything. If you start saying, oh, the Russians are stupid putting these prison in jail, putting these people in prison, because that's not going to help Pussy Riot at all, you know. And assuming everybody in Russia is anti-Putin is a pretty bad assumption as well, because people we met there, actually, they didn't particularly like him, but they didn't particularly not like him. They felt, because they had more stuff, they had proper shops, you know, whereas 20 years ago, everything's boarded up. It's like, they're living in the good times there, even though you lose freedoms, but you get more pullovers to buy. It's that weird chicken capitalism, isn't it?
I mean, my impression, I've never been to Russia, but from studying Russia and so on, my impression is that it's a place where Putin is genuinely popular because he, you know, he has the sort of Russian pride, I guess, which the end of the Soviet Union sort of, you know, took away, and so he's brought that back by being nationalistic and so on. I mean, is the punk community at all like that? I mean, you said there's right wingers. Are people do the people in the punk community think Pussy Riot should have been jailed? I mean, do they sympathise with the position of the Russian Church?
A lot of people I've emailed since this happened in Russia. I was quite surprised by their thoughts. I mean, I thought they'd be thinking, oh, this is terrible, this is embarrassing for our country. And then a couple of people did say that. But a lot of people I speak to, and I speak to some Russians I know in Manchester today, who are very liberal people, and they're saying, oh, yes, of course they should be put in jail because of what they did. And I think people got the wrong end of the idea about the case. I think people think they went to the church and like trashed the whole church and beat up an old lady. I think there's obviously a bit of a tabloid manipulation with the story in Russia, so people don't quite understand what it's actually about. A lot of people think they're just like rich girls, and they don't like that either. So I think people maybe don't have the whole story. You know, I don't think it's like a blanket 90% rating in Putin's favour in Russia. I think people in Russia are fearful of certain things. They think Putin could probably stand up against, and that's why people see him. It's like maybe they think he's a lesser of different evils or something. But you know, so the Russian punk scene is not a particularly political punk scene. When we were there, it was basically just loads of kids. It'd be like going to the stadium gig, which is never a very good measure of any kind of thinking. It was basically like loads of 18-year-old kids who just want to jump up and down to bands that play fast, noisy music, and they weren't political at all, really. They were kind of anti-Chechnya and slightly anti-Muslim because of the fear that was going to attack Russia. It was talk about 4 years ago as well, so I don't think it might have changed since then. And we did. There was a bad skinhead thing going on as well. And you see them dressed up. We saw them in the park dressed up in like military uniforms. That was like unusual. I thought they're the army, but they're actually a skinhead militia, Nazi one, right wing one. But saying that, it's not like everybody in Russia is like that. You know, it's a big sprawling country. I think it's one of the countries that's so big that the government seems an awful long way away from you. You know, it's bad enough in this country, but when you go to like somewhere like Russia. I mean, I was in a big city like St. Petersburg or Moscow, but what the hell's it like in a little town 1,000 miles away? You must feel. I mean, I'd imagine most people in Russia don't even know Pussy Riot even exists. I doubt it's like that big a news story there, and I doubt it's part of the mainstream debate that's going on. I think it's one of those things that people in the West are more concerned about.
So, would you care to speculate on how you think it will all play out? I mean, we saw just the other day one of the three jailed members of Pussy Riot get released. Do you think we'll see the other two follow shortly, or are they in for the long haul?
I was kind of hoping they would all get released just because it's such a stupid thing, but like I said before, to put them in prison. It actually makes your government look weaker. Like, you're just scared of the three people just jumping around in a church, which if you're like running a huge, basically it's an empire, which is a massive, it's like, it's a 24-hour train journey from one end to the other. If you own all that, how you bother about three people just wearing balaclavas jumping about? It does make you look stupid, doesn't it, really, if you bother about that. And if they ignored it in the first place, they wouldn't have this whole problem now. So I thought that this with the appeal would be like an excuse just to let them out, but obviously they thought if we let one out and keep two in, maybe we'll do a bit of divide and rule, and we'll show we're sort of liberal, but we're not really. So they can look hardline for the hardliners and liberal for the liberals, and it's a bit of a fudge, isn't it? You just wonder, like, maybe in a year, maybe they'll let the other two out and hopefully nobody will notice. I mean, I wonder if they were thinking if they could get them out without being in any papers or anybody talking about it. Maybe that's the way they would try and do it. It does seem incredibly draconian, like 2 years just seems utterly like a ridiculous amount of time, doesn't it?
It's utterly bizarre, and it's a story that our show will certainly be covering again, and we'll put links to find out more about Louder Than War and all of that sort of thing on our website. So John Roberts, it's been fascinating, thank you very much.
Alright, cool, nice one. Yeah.
Now, a new study, which has been released literally today, reveals a striking connection between brain trauma and a tendency towards criminal behaviour, particularly in young offenders, with over half of those in prison having suffered some form of head injury. Here's neuroscientist and occasional Podillusion contributor and Guardian columnist Dean Burnett to explain how this occurs, what it means, and what can be done about it.
There is a new report released today, Friday the 19th of October 2012, if you're listening to this after today. Which you may well be. It's titled Repairing Shattered Lives, Brain Injury and Its Implications for Criminal Justice. It's written by Professor Hugh Williams of Exeter University and commissioned by the Barrow-Cadbury Trust for the Transition to Adulthood T2A Alliance. It makes some surprising and rather alarming claims if you're not familiar with the data, which most people aren't. Apparently, 60% of young people in custody report having experienced some kind of brain injury. That's a direct quote. To put that into perspective, incidence of brain injury is typically much, much higher in the population under 25, but apparently even higher again for under 25s who find themselves involved in the criminal justice system, up to 60% of a population, which is more than half, as you can probably tell. It would be easy to read or hear this and conclude that, via some complex but poorly understood mechanism, brain injury turns young people into criminals. In fact, I would say it's depressingly likely that this precise claim will be made or have been or has already been made by some prominent media establishment, maybe before you even hear this. However, as always, when it comes to neuroscientific aspects and large social structures and society systems, the implications of the report are far more subtle and complex than that. It's important to understand the rationale behind the Transition to Adult Alliance. What do they do? What are they for? They promote effective approaches for young people in the transition to adulthood, meaning 16 to 25 years old, throughout the criminal justice process. That is what they do. But simply, as far as the criminal justice system is concerned, people aged over 18 are rational, mature adults and should be treated as such when caught engaging in criminal behaviour. The Transition to Adulthood Alliance argue that this approach is at best unhelpful, at worst actually making criminal behaviour more likely in the long term. And, of course, there are arguments for this. We often forget that the majority of age limits imposed by society are potentially relatively arbitrary. A good example of this has been in the news recently, with 16-year-olds potentially being allowed to vote in the Scottish referendum, rather than 18-year-olds and above, as is standard in the UK. Age limits and restrictions rarely correspond with scientific reality. A 16-year-old isn't automatically more resistant to the damage and effects of smoking than a 14-year-old, but, well, at least until recently, the cut-off point for legal age of smoking was 16. Now, this isn't to dismiss age restrictions as irrelevant or illogical. They exist for very good reasons. For instance, in the strictest biological sense, the concept of an underage pregnancy is technically nonsensical. If a female is physiologically capable of becoming pregnant, then she's old enough to reproduce as far as nature is concerned. But our society rightly recognises that just because someone is biologically capable of doing something, they're not necessarily mentally capable of doing it without causing damage to themselves or, perhaps more importantly, others. Ensuring that an individual is mature enough to understand and handle the consequences of potentially damaging actions is why age restrictions exist, you could say. But this concept of maturity is where problems arise. As soon as someone reaches a legally determined age, they don't automatically mature overnight. There is no internal no-yes maturity switch that gets flipped. Biology is not binary, cognition even less so. The criminal justice system works under the assumption that, once an individual is 18, they are mature enough to be considered a typical adult. The T2A argue that this is not the case, that young adults should be recognised as a distinct group by the criminal justice system, and their maturity, cognitive development, and socioeconomic factors should be considered when processing them, for things up to and including sentencing. There is, of course, scientific evidence to support this claim. A Birmingham University Extensive Literature Review, also commissioned by the T2A, supports this view. Recent studies into post-adolescent brain development have revealed that our brains continue to develop well into our 20s, and they don't sort of peak and stop by age 18, as was previously believed. And these developments are concerned with more complex abilities such as executive functioning and inhibition, abilities which overrule our need for immediate reward, moderate our impulsive actions, and regulate our emotions, all of which are what the majority of people would recognise as signs of maturity. But this applies to normal young adults, normal inverted commas. This new report now reveals another factor that has a serious impact on the cognitive development and behaviour of young adults, that of brain injury and trauma. It is important to remember that brain injury is a very serious matter, not like in the films when someone is knocked out in a fight only to come round a few seconds or minutes later, make a witty quip, and carry on as if nothing had happened. Concussion is a serious enough business, even if it does not cause lasting damage. But any injury to the head that causes a period of unconsciousness should be taken very seriously, as it could result in serious long-term injury. Given the complexity of the brain and uncertain nature of brain injury, the eventual consequences of traumatic brain injury can vary considerably, potentially leading to serious disorders. This is even more significant in younger people, as it could lead to a significant disruption in cognitive development as well as just damage. The developing brain can show remarkable resilience for such complex and fragile organ, but in the cases of severe injury, it is more a case of compensation than repair. The brain works around damage rather than undoing it, which means that brain development can be disrupted in the long term. And as the report suggests, these disruptions can lead to an increased tendency for criminal behaviour, because someone's inhibitions, their long-term planning, their emotional control is limited and compromised by brain injury. As it states, those without a TBI, or traumatic brain injury, are likely to grow out of immature and antisocial behaviour by their mid-20s. Those with traumatic brain injury are likely to continue to grapple with these issues throughout young adulthood and beyond. That's another direct quote from the report. It must be emphasised, this does not mean that young people who suffer brain injury go on to become criminals. Many don't. A police database of all young people who have suffered head injuries would be unnecessary, invasive, and largely useless. And the relationship is also two-way, it's not just a one-to-one system. There are those who are already more prone to risky behaviour, like criminal acts, are far more likely to find themselves in contexts where head injury occurs, meaning it could be the criminal behaviour that leads to the brain injury, not the other way around. But in young adults, brain injury increases the likelihood of eventual criminal behaviour. It's not a cause per se, but it can raise the chances of someone turning to criminal acts. Overall, the evidence suggests that brain injury can be a significant variable in the occurrence and prevention of criminal behaviour, and as such should be considered when taking sentencing and rehabilitation into account. However, at present, young people aren't screened for brain injury at all, and thus are rarely, if ever, referred to for necessary rehabilitation. As a result, the primary contact that many young people with brain injury have with service providers is via the criminal justice system, which is obviously ill-equipped to deal with and treat brain trauma, which is arguably as it should be. That's not what it's responsible for. But the Shattered Lives report put forward a strong evidence and a case for this to change. Young offenders should be screened for brain injury, they say, and this should be addressed via relevant treatments and therapies when attempting rehabilitation. This approach could cut reoffending rates and eventually reduce the cost to the taxpayer of the criminal justice system. There are, of course, many complications to be considered when proposing such a system. For example, no two brain injuries are likely to be exactly the same, so symptoms and appropriate treatments would vary considerably between individuals. There is also the matter of whether people who train to deal with young offenders are qualified or even capable of recognising the signs and consequences of brain injury. Why would they be? How would the extent of brain trauma suffered be determined? It would be impractical, to say the least, to install an MRI scanner and qualified operators in every police station. And related to initial concerns over the maturity of young offenders, how would one determine the level of an abstract concept of such as maturity that an individual possesses? Much of these concerns could potentially be addressed. Work is already in progress on tools like targeted questionnaires, and training in their use could easily be provided. But then, this logically relies on offenders being open and honest with authority figures responsible for prosecuting them, which would require a degree of maturity and control. The whole point of the process is that they may lack these things. There is no quick and easy solution to the issues raised in the report, but a greater awareness of the effect developmental maturity and brain injury can have on criminal behaviour in young adults can only be a benefit to the criminal justice system and society as a whole. Nobody is actually arguing that young offenders shouldn't be punished for the crimes they commit, but by taking into account the effect developmental maturity and brain injury can have on their behaviour, it could greatly reduce the likelihood of the punishment being needed again. This is Dean Burnett, a qualified neuroscientist. This was actually written originally as a piece for The Guardian, which is an article which should be live today on the website. If you want to check it there in text format, check out my other blog at The Guardian, Brain Flap Into, if you're bored, and hopefully you'll be contributing to the Pod Illusion again sometime. Depends if I have anything interesting to say.
Now, one of the interesting things to come out of the agreement about the Scottish independence referendum this week is that, according to the plan, the lower age limit on being able to vote will be 16, rather than the traditional 18. And this raises all sorts of interesting questions about what the voting age should be in all elections. Personally, I think that the best thing to do if we want to encourage young people to take an interest in politics is for voting to remain banned for under-18s. In fact, it should come with health warnings, a bit like smoking. You know, warnings like, caution, voting may seriously damage your belief in democracy. They could be printed on every ballot paper, for instance. Maybe we should go even further and print horrible photos on the outside of polling booths to point out the dangers of voting. I mean, I imagine a picture of Jeremy Hunt is enough to put anyone off of a sordid and harmful activity like politics. Now, here's the genius bit. This will prove irresistible, surely. All kids know that smoking is super cool, and like this, kids will be soon putting on deep voices and asking people outside polling stations to go in and cast a vote for them. Anyway, to not examine my brilliant idea anymore, here's Corey Hazelhurst.
So there's going to be a referendum on Scottish independence in 2014. Alex Salmond and David Cameron signed an agreement this week that paves the way for 2 years of bickering about the Barnett formula, where we'll put nuclear weapons if we can't keep them off the Scottish coast, and what would happen if Scotland applied to join the EU. It's going to be a roller coaster ride. If by a roller coaster ride you mean a long, torturous journey through tartan sludge, whilst very enthusiastic but earnest people rattle off a barrage of meaningless statistics. But there is an issue about the independence vote, which intrigues me, as someone who's interested in democratic reform issues. 16 and 17-year-olds are going to be allowed the chance to vote in the independence referendum. This was apparently Salmond's bargaining chip, in exchange for having a single question on whether Scotland should have independence, rather than adding a second question on whether they should have greater devolved powers. This announcement has led to some debate on whether 16-year-olds should have the vote in UK elections, and I'd like to explore this issue in this piece. First, let's discuss the implications of giving 16-year-olds the vote in the independence referendum. To be honest, the impact's going to be quite minimal. Peter Kellner, of the pollster YouGov, estimated that adding these young voters to the electoral roll will increase the independence vote by 0.2%, and he concedes that even this might be an optimistic figure. Despite this, it's quite clear that Salmond wanted 16 and 17-year-olds to receive the vote because they're more likely to vote for independence, by an average of 10 points more than most Scottish voters. The justification for this is that young people are the future of an independent Scotland and should therefore have some say in its creation. But then why shouldn't 4-year-olds be given the vote in the referendum then? Or maybe pregnant women should get 2 votes? But what I find most depressing is that democratic reform doesn't happen in the UK because of a careful weighing up of evidence or out of a desire to create a functioning democracy, but instead because principle happens to coincide with self-interest. At this point, I wanted to speak for 3 hours on the problem of getting proper democratic reform in the UK and why such a change is necessary. But James has asked me to cut this bit for reasons of space. So I'll get back to the topic at hand. A lot of the debates about votes at 16 end up being about rather superficial issues. For instance, some have argued that 16-year-olds shouldn't get the vote because most wouldn't bother voting. But 60% of 18 to 25-year-olds don't vote at the moment anyway. Should we take away their vote? Surely the issue of votes at 16 should be decided on its own merits, rather than based on unfalsifiable fretting about turnout. What's more, international evidence does suggest that giving 16-year-olds the vote might not lead to a big decrease in turnout. In 1996, 16-year-olds were allowed to vote in Lower Saxony regional elections for the first time in Germany, and in Hanover, turnout among 16 to 17-year-olds was 56.5%. Compare that to about 49% of 18 to 24-year-olds, and an overall turnout of 57%. In later 1999 elections, the available data found that a third of 16 to 17 year olds voted in the elections, compared to 32% of 18 to 21 year olds, and an overall turnout of 38%. Another Duff argument put forward is that 16 year olds don't have sufficient life experience to cast a vote. If you were being cruel, you could easily say this about many voters over 18 who are already entitled to vote. How much life experience is necessary for one to cast an effective vote? Should we only allow those who've travelled to more than 5 foreign countries to vote? Or perhaps only those who've taken Class A drugs have a sufficient amount of life experience to be deemed worthy of having the vote? Although on second thoughts, if we did that, turnout in elections would be restricted to Louise Mensch and Russell Brand. The best report looking at the actual evidence of votes at 16 was produced by the Electoral Commission in 2004. It was the result of a lengthy consultation process. It's well worth a read. We'll put a link to it on the Pod Delusion website. The report starts by examining the other legal minimum ages enforced throughout the UK. Those campaigning for votes at 16 often state that a 16-year-old can marry, join the army, and pay tax, but can't vote. As one campaign to extend the franchise once put it, there should be no taxation without representation. However, the Electoral Commission pointed out that these rights are often partial. Teenagers who join the army can't be put into a combat situation until they're 18 years old, and those who marry before the age of 18 in England and Wales need the consent of their parents first. The Electoral Commission argued that the right of 16 and 17-year-olds to vote should be argued on its own unique merits, rather than linked to other rights they receive. They cite evidence from the 1960s, which suggests that social majority begins in the early teens, between ages of about 13 and 15, to make the point that, and I quote, "Young people under the age of 18 have probably begun to develop the important requirements of social and emotional maturity." The Commission also argue that what's most important is whether society thinks that 16 is an age at which people are mature enough to make an informed decision. Polling conducted by ICM for the consultation suggests that, on the whole, society doesn't think votes should be given to 16-year-olds. It found that overall 78% of people say the voting age should be kept at 18. As you might expect, the older people are, the more hostile they were to the proposal. 95% of those aged over 65 were opposed to votes at 16. Yet opinion is divided amongst young people as well. It found that 54% of 15 to 19-year-olds were opposed to votes at 16, and only 35% of 15 to 19-year-olds were in favour. The reason given by most young teenagers themselves for not having the right to vote was because they felt they had insufficient information with which to make an informed choice, which you could say is an incredibly responsible attitude to have. The Electoral Commission recommended that the voting age should remain at 18. Because most established democracies set the voting age at 18, the Commission felt the onus was on those campaigning for a change in the law to make their case. It concluded that the current case was not sufficiently strong to grant votes at 16, but that the age of majority should be reviewed on a periodic basis. The case for giving young people the vote at 16 would depend on two things, said the Commission. Firstly, on the development of citizenship education in schools, and secondly, on social attitudes to the age of majority. Judging from a Sunday Times poll, which found 63-29% of people were opposed to votes at 16, this has not quite happened yet. In 1969, Harold Wilson's government reduced the voting age from 21 to 18. It was thought that Labour would win the next election on the back of the youth vote, but instead, they unexpectedly lost to Edward Heath in the 1970 general election. The moral of the story is, when deciding the age of majority, politicians should be careful what they wish for, and that includes Alex Salmond. This was Corey Hazelhurst for the Pod Delusion.
So over the last couple of weeks, we've seen this year's Nobel Prize winners announced. Once again, I was snubbed, despite my extensive research into the effects of laziness upon the human body. Ugh, there's always next year, I guess, you know, when I might actually fill in the application form, if I can be bothered. But it does make you wonder, why are the Nobel Prizes so important? And how are they picked anyway? And why won't they pick me? Not that I'm bitter or anything.
So, to answer these questions and more, here's Cash Farouk speaking to Nobel expert Simon Franz.
Hi, Simon. Can you introduce yourself and explain why you sort of know so much about the Nobel Prizes?
My name is Simon Franz, and the reason why I've been interested in Nobel Prizes is because I was senior editor on the official website nobelprize.org for several years, and I did that job until about sort of middle of last year. So I'd spent 3 or 4 years working, creating content around the prizes, and worked around the announcements, and created lots of educational content about the history and the legacy of the prizes.
Okay, so let's start with Alfred Nobel. Who was he?
He was a genius. He was a scientist. He was an inventor. He was an entrepreneur. When Alfred Nobel died in San Remo in 1896, he was actually one of the richest men in the world. The legacy he gave that set up the prizes was over £200 million, which in 1896 is an extraordinarily huge amount of money. He was, by all accounts, a very private man. There's, even though we know a great deal about him through the prizes, there's relatively very little we know about him as a person. He was very private. He was a workaholic. He constantly travelled. He had no time for a private life. He was prone to bouts of depression. And by his own admission, he was a misanthrope and a loner. But he had this sort of legacy of the engineering field, because his father was an engineer who produced mines for the Russian army. Nobel began sort of developing his own interest in creating explosives for engineering, and after a few sort of experiments and trying different things, he sort of came up with his major crowning achievement, which was dynamite. After a few years, he created the global industrial empire. He was one of the first big sort of industrial magnates, and the reason why he was so successful and why he made so much money off the explosives was that dynamite and all the other explosives he was creating was pretty much instrumental in the industrialization of the Western world. So it was being used from creating the Trans-Siberian Railway, it was being used to create the Panama Canal. And over the years, Nobel developed a full or a partial hand in around 90-odd production sites in 20 countries. I mean, he even had a factory in Scotland, which is a place to the southwest of Glasgow. He was a tireless inventor that we know about him. He tried to develop a new type of bicycle. He tried to develop a boat made of aluminium. He had private laboratories in his homes in Sweden, France, and Italy. And he amassed around, they think, about 350, 355 patents by the time he died. So he was extremely prolific. And what we know that then is that he died of a stroke at the age of 63 on the 10th of December, 1896.
Okay, and that brings us to the prize fund that was set up. So can you talk about what happened when Nobel died and what happened when his will was first read out?
A few days after Nobel died, the will was opened up, much the shock of his family in particular, because Nobel, in his will, gave a small amount of money to family members, but stated that the vast majority of his fortune, which is well over 90%, should be invested in what he called was safe securities by his executors, and they were to put it into a fund, and the interest of that would be distributed annually in the form of prizes to those who, during the preceding year, had conferred the greatest benefit to mankind. Now, there was no real indication that he was going to do this. He'd actually spent the final years of his life tweaking his will, and the version that was read out was written only the year before in the Swedish-Norwegian club in Paris. The question is, people always ask, is why did he do that? Why did he want to give his money to set up some sort of prizes? And there's some stories about there. There's one story that a French newspaper published an obituary of Alfred Nobel while he was alive, and they headlined it, The Merchant of Death is Dead. And what had happened was they'd actually confused Alfred with his brother Ludwig, who died from heart disease. And one story goes that the shock of seeing this headline made him think about what his legacy was going to be. I'm not quite sure how true that is, but one thing we do know about him from some of his writings was that he considered himself to be a social democrat. He believed that sort of inheritance would spoil the next generation. You know, you had to earn your own money, not acquire it. That was sort of easy for him to say because he had no children, but we know that was his point of view.
Okay, and the prize fund, is it still just funded from Nobel's will?
To all intents and purposes, it is, yes. They, as you can imagine, if you receive over £200 million to set up prizes, that you've got a lot of money there to work with, although the foundation go to great efforts to make sure they invest the money in the right way and distribute the money in the right way.
Okay, on to the actual prize awards. Can you explain what the selection process is, how it works, how the winners are actually chosen?
The way that Nobel Prizes are selected every year is actually quite a long process and quite an involved process. It takes about a year from beginning to end. So what happens is, for next year's prizes, for example, that there will be a group of letters sent out to a select band of people who get a chance to nominate people for prizes. It's a nomination-based process. If you're not nominated for a prize, you can't be in the running for it. And so each prize has a set list of people there they can send nominations out to. So it's usually laureates, professors in Scandinavian universities, select professors from around the world, etc., etc. And letters go out at the end of September seeking nominations, and the deadline for that is usually around the 31st of January. So anything after that doesn't get considered, or if nominations come in late, they're usually considered for the year afterwards. Once the nominations come in, then they begin the process of whittling down that list. Now, on average, you tend to get about 250 to 350 names nominated every year. And what will happen then between March and, say, July, the committee will reduce that down to a short list of, say, about five or six possibilities. And then they will spend the summer writing up reports on that. So they'll go through all the research that people have done. They'll have conversations with people. What they're trying to do is they're trying to establish two things. They're trying to establish what the prize should be for. That is, what's the discovery or the finding that you're actually rewarding that you think is worthy of the prize. And you're also trying to find out who is worthy of the prize, who were involved with those key discoveries. And that takes all of summer to create those reports. And then after the summer they return and they present those cases to the prize committees, and they get to vote on it. You can only get a prize if it's a majority vote. What tends to happen is they arrive at a final decision, but they on the actual morning of the announcement, what they will do is they will have an official vote. So they'll meet all the members, and they'll say, we're going to give this prize for this and to these people, do we all agree? And if they get a majority vote, then that's it, that's the official business over. And then they have about an hour or so to contact the new recipients of the prize before they announce it to the public.
So apart from the prestige, what do they actually receive? You know, what do they win?
So each laureate will receive a medal, and they will receive a diploma, which is a hand-painted certificate which tells you what the prize has been given for, and they receive a sum of money. And the sum of money is 8 million Swedish krona this year, which I think is around £750,000, and that gets split between whether it's one, two, or three people who receive the prize.
Okay, great. And finally, to wrap up, have you got a Nobel Prize anecdote for us?
The best anecdotes that I have is just, and it sounds a bit cheesy, and I know it sounds a bit cheesy, but it's when you're there witnessing them get the prize in Stockholm, and you get to see the family being incredibly happy, and you get to see the postdocs in the lab who are there, who are part of the research as well, knowing that their research has been deserving of a prize. That's always the fun part for me, because it sends out a big message that basic research, kind of blue sky research that the Nobel Prizes honour, are important. And it's always the kind of research that is just simply a matter of people trying to answer questions. No one knows where the research is going. There's no obvious practical application. It just turns out that their work and further work has research that impacts on our lives. And I like the idea of them honouring the fact that if you just want to answer a question and you work hard and you're clever enough and you're talented enough, you can do work that changes the world.
Okay, that's a great place to end. Simon Frantz, thank you very much.
Thanks, Cash.
Now let's talk about women. Personally, I was on the fence until this week, when two events made me think that maybe women are pretty awesome after all. Last Tuesday was Ada Lovelace Day, named for arguably the world's first computer programmer. And so to celebrate her legacy and to celebrate women who work in science and technology, events were held around the world, including Ada Lovelace Day Live in London, which was great fun. And we might have a podcast of this soon, depending on a number of very boring technical things. Anyway, also yesterday saw the official launch of the Science Girl calendar. That's girl spelt with a double R, of course. So upset were some people after seeing the awful Science It's a Girl Thing video that did the rounds a while back, and we covered at the time, that they put together a calendar showing real women who actually work in science doing their thing. Unfortunately, my application to be in the calendar was also declined, much like my Nobel, after it turned out that I'm not a woman, and I don't work in science, and apparently the calendar was the sort where people actually wear clothes. I guess there's always next year for that as well. To find out more about the calendar, though, Liz Luckendorf has been speaking to Heather Williams, the director of the project.
How many of you remember? Science! It's a girl thing. The video complete with dashes of eyeshadow and splashes of lipstick all in glorious pinks and purples. Remember? Have you shouted expletives like it was the first time? Well, good news. There are those in science that fight for the forces of accurate portrayals of women in science. And they are Science Girl. I talked to Heather Williams, one of the forces of good behind the project, about just exactly what they're doing about it. I first asked her to refresh her minds back to why that video was just so awful.
I think the main problem for me was that it was meant to sell science to girls and young women, and there wasn't really any science happening in it at all. There was several pretty girls in very short skirts and very heavy makeup strutting about and giggling, and an impossibly handsome man with a microscope in a lab coat. But there are no guys like that in any lab I've ever visited, and not any science being done by any of the girls. So I thought, hang on a minute, is women doing science so dull and so boring that they have to try and sell it with something as artificial as this? I actually got quite offended, I think, really. And that's where the grrr came from, to do something as an alternative.
So what is Science Girl, then, as a thing?
It's still in formation stages, to be honest. I mean, we set out to produce a series of images that show what female scientists really look like and what they really do. And we're using a calendar as a vehicle for those images to get them into circulation and raise some money as well along the way. But as we've gone along, we've collected a lot of people who share our aims of getting more girls and young women interested in science and supporting those who are already working in science. So I now would describe us as a network of people who are passionate about what we do as scientists and passionate about passing that on to the next generation. And what we do next is still up for discussion. I think we've been working so hard to get the calendar finished, we haven't really come up for air since July.
When I interviewed Sue Charman-Anderson about Ada Lovelace Day a few weeks ago, she mentioned that they wrote to this European agency that put together this ridiculous video, and they didn't even deign to respond to them, to any offer of help or anything. Have you tried any of that? Have you tried to contact this agency that put out this horrible video?
I've actually had a few sort of brushes with them on Twitter of kind of, because I think the actual campaign itself, if you look at the website, I mean, the styling is hideous with sort of lipstick logos and things, but the actual content is actually really good. And it's a real shame that they launched it using this video and have turned off so many people because it's associated with that. I think it's that association rather the project itself that's kind of put me off. I mean, maybe in the future we can work together and develop something that's better. But at the moment, everyone just goes, science, it's a girl thing, and remembers that hideous video. So maybe if it had a different title and was completely relaunched, it would be much better. And I think they're actually trying to source an alternative video made by girls doing science themselves to sort of remarket it, which would be so much better. And why they didn't do that in the first place, I've no idea.
Have you ever interacted, other than this one time, with any of these kind of agencies or government bodies that seem to miss the mark entirely? Do you think there's a general lack of engagement with grassroots organisations or, you know, STEM bodies and things like that?
Yeah, I think it is difficult because once an organisation becomes established, it needs formal structures to govern how it works, and it very quickly becomes an institution. And the reason why Science Girl has taken off the way it has is because we're a network of volunteers who are connected via social media. We respond very quickly to what people are telling us and people who get in touch with us. I think that's part of the problem. It's lack of responsiveness that can be an issue, because if you have to take something through four committees to get anything done, then by the time you address an issue, it was yesterday's news. So I think it's not necessarily that those bodies are inherently out of touch. It's just the way they engage, perhaps, is behind the times.
So what kind of engagement would you like to see if they could get past this four committee type thing?
I think I'd like to see more connection between professional scientists and young women and girls themselves. One initiative I'm already involved with is the STEM Ambassadors Network. I've been a STEM ambassador for years, and they basically get professionals into schools to do careers fairs and talks and workshops. And unless a young person meets someone who's a professional physicist or a chemist or a biologist in a particular field, they probably won't know that those things even exist or that they're accessible to people like them. And I'd actually like to see more of that kind of one-on-one connection and people realising, oh, actually, I wouldn't mind growing up to be someone like you. Because it's very easy to, if you just have one or two high-profile role models, that they almost establish a different stereotype of what you have to be a scientist. Whereas if you have young people connecting with a wide range of role models, then they're more likely to come across someone who really makes a difference to them.
So you've decided to do this, the Science Girl calendar. What are your goals with the calendar?
I think the principal aim was to show what we're dubbing the female face of science. Obviously, we can't represent every single female scientist in 13 pictures, and we can't represent every single scientific discipline that women work in 13 pictures. But we've tried to get a wide range of disciplines. There is a slight bias towards physics, which is entirely my fault. We're really trying to cover a wide range of people, a wide range of disciplines, and showing people working in team as much as possible as well, because there's often this idea that as a scientist, you're tucked away in a lab on your own, and it's quite an antisocial career, and that's quite off-putting to most girls, I think, that they're going to be isolated by doing science. And we've also got a fair number of guys in there as well, because we don't want to replace male domination with female domination. We want to see men and women working in partnership, and they do that, so why not show that in the calendar?
So who is going to be in the calendar? Who's getting involved?
Ooh, well, we just went to print on Tuesday, so we have I have the final shot list in front of me. People that may be recognised, Professor Dame Nancy Rothwell, who's the president of Manchester University, Tamsin Edwards, who's done some stuff on Radio 4 about the Higgs boson and other such exciting things, Helen Zersky, who's a bubbles physicist. She's the coolest research field ever. It's like, I work on champagne and things. No, she doesn't really. She does oceanography, but she does some TV as well. I think those are sort of the girls, the best known of them. Of the guys, we've got Dallas Campbell, James Logan, Kevin Fong. Sort of people that you probably will have seen at least in passing on TV or have heard their names.
The most important question then is, when is it launching and how can people get one?
Yes, that is indeed the most important question. We actually go on sale on the 18th of October. Then it'll be available not only on the website, but also at the Science Museum shop in London and the Museum of Science and Industry shop in Manchester. So you can either buy online and have it delivered to your door, or you can buy from the Science Museum in London or in Manchester.
If you'd like to rewatch the video that the EU would rather you forget, or more importantly, buy a calendar, just follow the links on the Poddelusion website. And keep an eye out for what Science Girl will get up to next. This has been Liz Lussendorf for the Poddelusion.
And that's just about it for this week's show. And if you head over to our website at poddelusion.co.uk, you can listen to over 3 years of archives, as well as tons more on the Poddelusion Extra feed. Also on our website, you can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter if you're into those sorts of things. And also, crucially, do check out the Soho Skeptics. It's a brand new monthly event in London, and it's going to be great fun. As I mentioned at the start of the show, the first meeting is on November the 7th with film director Chris Atkins, who will be taking a look at media manipulation from Leveson to Hillsborough and beyond. And then we'll have monthly meetings from then, and other guests currently lined up include Ben Goldacre, Jim Milinovich and Adam Rutherford. So do head over to poddelusion.co.uk and follow the links to the Soho Skeptics for more on all that. And if you have enjoyed this week's Poddelusion, then please do subscribe and donate £5 or £10 a month, or make a one-off donation. All donations are hugely appreciated and really do help us keep making this show week in, week out. It's a bit like buying us a couple of drinks a month. So if you have enjoyed the show, please do head over to poddelusion.co.uk and click on the donate links. The Poddelusion this week was brought to you by Dean Burnett, Corey Hazelhurst, Cash Farouk, Liz Luckendorf, Salim Fadley, and me, James O'Malley, with much additional editing by Liz Luckendorf. The Sketch of the Moment is by David Lovesey and Brian Too. The Poddelusion is a partner of the British Humanist Association. Thanks for listening.
Milk?
Oh, just a snifter, Freya. It's only just gone 10.
Number 10, you mean? Do you know what? I read in the Mail today we're supposed to be having a Downing Street feud, Larry.
What? Preposterous. The only cat feud I like are my sachets of Sheba.
Very droll. Just because your owner is the Prime Minister and mine is the Chancellor of the Exchequer, we're expected to fight about everything.
Oh, I heard something that'll raise a purr. What's worse than furballs?
Oh, go on.
Edballs.
Dave
telling George that one at conference. Apparently, he makes them sick as well.
What I find most ironic is that as Chancellor, my master thinks he's in charge of the kitty. I'm the boss, George.
Too right. I was just thinking something similar at PMQs yesterday.
PMQs?
Yes, pummeling mice quietly sessions. George Osborne spent the day balancing the budget, and you spent all the evening balancing a budgie.
Not my fault. Nick Clegg left the cage door open.
Well, something else to apologise for.
Tell me, Larry, what's yellow and red all over?
I've no idea.
Clegg's budgie when I'd finished chewing. Meow, 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 meow.
Come on, Freya. I've got an idea. It'll be a real pussy riot.
Oh, do tell, Larry.
Well, let's pad off to Nick Clegg's office and take a dump in his chair.
Oh, that's you, is it?
No, not just me. Everyone at number 10 does it.
What, everybody?
Yes, he's not popular, Freya. Do you know what? Even Vince lays a cable.